Talk given Saturday, 25th November, 1978. We may well wonder how many people in the world, including ourselves, truly see that the complete fulfillment of man, the fulfillment of the purpose of his existence, the goal of all the great teachings by the founders of the religions and all spiritual teachers, can be put in these words. It is the realization of the eternal silence. That complete rest, that ultimate Sabbath, that peace and harmony which we cannot define or imagine, is the eternal silence. That silence of which it was said in the Subala Upanishad, then death becomes one with the Supreme. This is the teaching of Nirvana. This is the teaching of all the Vedas. It's an extraordinary ending to that Upanishad. The eternal silence. What do we commonly think of or understand by the word silence? We think of it as the opposite of noise. We think of it as the opposite of any sound. And the sound that we human beings make is usually associated with our faculty of speech. To be silent means to refrain from producing audible sounds. But then there are also the inaudible sounds. The process that goes on in the brain when we say, which we talk of as thinking. That perhaps is the first meaning of the word silence. The cessation of audible sounds. And for those who understand more, the cessation of inaudible sounds, namely our process which we call thinking. But is it only that much? Or is there something more to it, something deeper? Something not a little more or slightly deeper merely, but very much deeper. So deep that we can never compass it. This silence is conditioned as far as our understanding of silence is concerned, by the functioning of our sense of hearing, first and foremost. Because if we look carefully into our own minds at work, we will find that the basic hidden meaning, which doesn't come easily into the light of the conscious mind, the basic hidden meaning is that which is heard or not heard. That's what's involved in that word silence. So, when we practice religious disciplines, we sometimes strive to silence the mind, the chatter of the brain. And just what happens? The brain chatters more than ever. One can suppress that chatter by various psychological and or physical tricks. One can silence it, suppress it. But is that the silence which is the supreme fulfillment? Not at all. Because notice afterwards that if one deliberately tries to sit down in meditation and stop the flow of thought, as we call it, when we come out of that effort, we talk or 10 times more than ever and very volubly as the reaction to the effort to suppress what is natural to the psychophysical organism at its own particular stage of development. We must look very carefully and deeply into this matter. The silence has to emerge naturally and spontaneously from within ourselves. It flows into us also from outside ourselves. It, to use a very good word, it supervenes when the real quietude in our own being has taken place. And it takes place because we become intensely aware of the noise, of that which produces the noise. And it is this which we might consider somewhat this afternoon. I have already mentioned how our idea of silence is conditioned by the functioning of our sense of hearing. Because our first meaning of silence is to stop talking. We learn that at home when parents or our elders tell us, be quiet, which means stop talking. And associated with that, stop making a noise with your toys or whatever you are doing. I see a young mother smiling. She knows. You see. So, it is associated with our sense of hearing and the operation of our sense of hearing. Our faculty of speech is perhaps one of the most remarkable faculties that the human organism possesses. It has become one of the supreme means of communication. And this faculty of speech is associated with our faculty through imagination of going through a succession of pictures in our mind, which also some people like to call thinking. They say, I think in pictures. I don't think in words. So it is, they disagree with the idea that speech, which we call thinking, what we call the process of thinking is merely a succession of words. They say, I do not have a succession of words, I see pictures all the time. But if you ask the question, how do you recognize your pictures? You know what they are, don't you? And they'll say, yes, of course I know what they are. Well, how do you know what they are? Excepting by naming them. What is the picture? If you can't name the items composing your picture, you can't visualize the picture. At the back of the mind, again, there is the word, language. Others will say, I think in a series of sounds, tunes, and so forth. Now this again is a subtle form of words. Those tunes are almost always associated with moods, with events, with all sorts of memories and so on. And so this naming process is not entirely limited to the use of our faculty of speech in the ordinary sense. Both speech, both audible and inaudible speech, is related to this activity of the brain. Very intimately tied up with it. And it won't stop. So if silence is going to be the opposite of that, then the ultimate goal is in a state of conflict with this, which naturally goes on in the organism. Let us just quietly listen and see if we can light up from within as to the immense significance of all this. The whole flow of words deals with that which begins, proceeds and ends, associating all that with one's self-concept, which is invariably, without exception, a misconcept. At best, it is only a partial concept, and its very partiality means that it misleads us. Now, since words deal with that which begins and ends, words belong to the context of that which is finite. that which is mortal. And being confined to finitude and mortality, it is obstructive to the total reality, to true inward freedom, the freedom of the spirit, the freedom of mind in the full and supreme sense of the word mind. And nevertheless, speech remains in our ordinary everyday life one of the supreme faculties which we have. Now, this speech, which is in conflict, is obviously against silence. It intrudes upon the reality of the eternal silence. And as we have tried to see, all our sense functions are obstructive, are obstructions to that silence. So our fundamental ideas about silence are somewhat short, they are somewhat faulty. Because the whole universe, the entire cosmos, is in a state of activity. An activity which is expressed through sound vibrations. So you see, there is likely to be, there could be, speech which is not obstructive to that eternal silence. And when I say speech, I don't mean merely speaking with one's mouth or writing down something, which is also all in words. And this is prophetic speech. When the prophet speaks as a prophet, is he intruding upon that eternal silence? Because, try and feel this quietly, deeply, that eternal silence is a harmony which passes our power, goes right beyond our powers of defining it. It is a harmony. The eternal silence is that harmony, which includes sound which is not obstructive to the silence. And prophetic speech which will include the functioning of all our senses, not only our sense of hearing, prophetic speech is that speech which remains not only speech but is also simultaneously thinking, feeling, and doing by the whole being. Prophetic speech is that speech which stimulates us when we hear it, in such a manner that we can thrill in response to this harmony. Prophetic speech has nothing whatever to do with foretelling the future. That's all childish stuff. Prophetic speech is of such a nature that it produces that kind of stimulus in the listener that awakens dormant faculties within his own organism, which enable him to perceive and act from within himself in such a manner that the process of his becoming free of all the defilements, the difficulties in his own psyche are removed. They are removed by the transformation of his psychical energy from expressing itself in a disharmonious manner into expressing itself, that psychical energy, expressing itself in a harmonious manner. Now this speech, and therefore also not only the functioning of our sense of hearing, but also of sight, taste, touch, smell, everything, is a pure functioning. And what will be one of the outstanding characteristics of this pure functioning of all the senses? There will be no association of the consciousness of oneself as the subject who is seeing, hearing, touching, tasting. There is the pure seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, etc. I wonder if you sort of can feel this, can respond to it inwardly, not just with the top layer of the brain cells, either for or against, but inwardly live this reality. If we can, then we shall begin to understand why the great spiritual teachers constantly warned us in connection with the functioning of our senses. And this warning by the great teachers has invariably, when their teaching became crystallized and organized and spread to hundreds and thousands of people, this warning got misinterpreted, misunderstood, and presented to us as a depreciation of the senses and sense functioning. So the teaching about the control of the senses actually was a teaching where we are encouraged to repress the senses, to suppress them. And in fact, even the best of scholars translating the old texts continuously keep using the word suppressing. For instance, in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the second sentence, the first one is now an exposition of yoga. Atha yogas anusashanam. Then comes yogas chitta vritti nirodha. And they all translate it, yoga is the suppression of the transformations of the thinking principle or the mind. The suppression. It isn't that at all. The whole discipline is such. And I mention yoga, but the same applies to each and every single great religious discipline. The whole discipline is such that these senses that we have become purified. They become transformed into chords of communion with reality, with the actual fact as it is, with truth. Because without the functioning of the physical senses in the right way, the psychical correspondent of the actual functioning process. By psychical correspondent, I mean something like this. You see an object and you say, ah, what a beautiful thing that is. I'd like to have it. Now this I'd like to have it is the fly in the ointment. But really to see it, and really to see it in completeness with the eye, either appreciating or not appreciating, completely out, means that the sense is functioning purely. If and when all the senses function that way, then the person, the living person, who is a fact of existence, the temporal fact, the spatio-temporal fact living now, he is no longer obtruding upon the cosmic process. He is at one with it. He is in harmony with it. So, he is seeing, touching, tasting, smelling, hearing, talking, performing action, in which inevitably and invariably sound is associated. But this sound is in harmony with the symphony of the cosmic process. It's not against it. And this extraordinary, wonderful symphony of the cosmic process is an ultimate silence, the ultimate meaning of silence. The primordial creative energy which releases through its functioning by means of that archetypal form of its own energy which we call mind, which releases the whole cosmos, that primordial creative energy is fully awake then to its own eternity, to its own immortality, to its own unimaginable, unthinkable silence. This is the true meaning of it. And what is the implication of that in connection with our own life? We live dualistically. I want, I don't want. I accept this, I reject that. I reject that because, having the conceit that I'm a good man, that I'm a religious person, and I live according to all the moral laws and so forth, this is evil. But the primordial creative energy rejects nothing. It accepts nothing. It can't reject anything. It can't accept anything. Because all that is constitutes that primordial creative energy. Put it in another form. Put it in a personalistic, theistic form. When Zarathustra speaks with Ahura Mazda and inquires of Ahura Mazda, the Supreme Being, Zarathustrianism was probably the first purely monotheist, a purely spiritual monotheistic religion. Zarathustra asks Ahura Mazda, what is the best means with which to deal with evil? He's talking at the dualistic level. The question is couched in the dualistic form. There is good, there is evil. I select the good, I'll work for the good, I reject the evil, I'll get rid of it. Ahura Mazda answers, our names, O Zarathustra, are the most powerful instrument for becoming free of evil. And then he details these names. He starts off by saying, my first name is, in the old Avastan, Ahammi. Anybody recognize the similarity of that sound to Asmi or Soham of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad? Or to the word Ehye in the book of Exodus, I am. Remember, the Supreme is talking. The Supreme as the absolute all. Your limited-minded theist might say, oh no, God has no evil in him. That part of creation which is evil will all be well dealt with in the right way later on by God. Not at all. Ahura Mazda proceeds. My second name is the Gatherer, rather neatly translated by modern scholars as the Shepherd. And he goes on mentioning names like that. And amongst them, he says, I am the whole good creation, excluding nothing. I am the whole good creation. The creative power, if we put it, we live in a scientific age, we understand the word energy. The primordial creative energy, itself unknown, unknowable. Somehow or other, out of it emerges its manifestation as the total cosmos, of which we are aware only in an infinitesimally small degree, despite all our libraries full of tomes which purport to reveal what this cosmos is. We know only such an infinitesimal fragment, and all the rest is the immeasurable unknown, the unimaginable silence. I am the whole good creation. So now, with respect to us, we have this conflict of good and evil, the living of the virtuous life as against the vicious life, the following of this path which leads to a perfection which we project out of our imperfect brains. We project it in words and pictures, and also sounds, harps and all the rest of it, you know. Don't we? So now, if we can begin to understand the significance, the tremendous, all-inclusive significance of the eternal silence, and that it belongs to the context of the immeasurable, the infinite, therefore indefinable, the nondescript, the immortal, the eternal, in the true sense of the word eternal, not in the dualistic sense which is used in the Buddhist texts, for instance, the mistake of annihilationism on the one hand and eternalism on the other hand. That is defining eternalism and annihilationism within the framework of a mind, a brain caught within the mortal dualistic mode of functioning. We have to use words like eternal and immortal to suggest, only to suggest, only to make the listener, to make oneself thrill to the fact that this transcendent reality, this transcendent beyond, is something which completely goes past our limited functioning. But there is that in us which can thrill to the unlimited functioning. And it is this thing which is dormant within the psychophysical organism, which is named man, a member of that particular animal species called human. Now you see, we mustn't take this sort of thing and try to manufacture a philosophy out of it. The moment we do that, we are gilding the lily. And the poor lily will just die, that's all. Or tearing apart the petals to discover what constitutes the unimaginable, the incredible beauty and perfection of that flower and its perfume. We are intruding upon the wholeness in doing that. We are destroying, besmirching the holiness. But now, if we can somehow manage to let this awareness of transcendence really permeate our being, suffuse our whole being, not offer any obstruction to it, and let it work by itself and not attempt to see what are the marvelous results that are coming, then it will happen by itself. You know, there's that very beautiful statement in a book. I think it was a book the Theosophical Society brought out in the very, very early days, end of the last century, by Mabel Collins. Grow as the flower grows. Now, if you and I grow or can grow as the flower grows, we will be entirely unconscious of our growth. And in actual fact, if you or I grow healthily, just bodily even, we are quite unconscious of it. How conscious was any one of us in our babyhood of our growth? We just growed up like Topsy, didn't we? We just growed up. This is the charm, the marvel of transcendence. It is unhindered by this rather stupid, super clever brain process. This analytical process. Let the analysis be there in our ordinary everyday lives, in its right context, for its particular purposes. But don't get misled by it. Don't say, now I know the truth of it. I don't. I've taken the watch to be pieces, and I can't put the pieces together again, and of course I can't use that watch to tell me the time. That is just what we do with our organisms. And how do we do it with our organisms? Indulging the senses. Deliberate indulgence of the senses, instead of using them rightly. And the little worm in the apple which makes us indulge the senses is the pleasure drive. The wanting satisfaction, the wanting fulfillment. But the moment I want, then I am abstracting from the whole world what is not my property. The truth, the flowering, the fulfillment, the glory, the beauty is not mine. You see the meaning of selflessness? Now, if you or I strive to be selfless, we shall again be tumbling into the pit. Because at the back of us will be the drive of the desire to become selfless in order that we may be fulfilled. There is no such thing as my fulfillment. Only the totality, only transcendence is fulfilled. in theistic terms, unto God the glory. Or as Sri Krishna put it, the Supreme, the Absolute All, is the reaper, the ultimate reaper. You, your business is with the action, your duty, your dharma. Duty is not a bad word, but it's too limited a word. Your dharma. And remember, dharma is derived from dhri, meaning to uphold. And what is it that you uphold? The entire universal process. How? By fulfilling your particular function in the universal process. It is the universe that runs each and every fragment of it. From the subatomic particle to the entire cosmos. It's the universe that runs it. And if we can really awaken to that, intelligently awaken to it, not as a thought, not as a pleasant philosophy, because then you'll get lazy and neglect your duties. But if you really awaken to it from within, then this universal energy will work through you unhindered. And it will find its fulfillment in terms which man will naturally and inevitably translate as truth, as beauty, as goodness, as love, as fulfillment, as happiness. That's your nirvana. But you won't know of it. If you will come to know about it, you will have a struggle and there will be a disharmony within your being. Just be nirvanic. That is also the meaning of being the true yogi, the true religia, the simple, pure human who lives the religious life. And in that is the realization of this extraordinary thing, the eternal silence.